From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Pandemic rescue dogs, especially the larger variety, can be challenging to train and exercise. Judging from the nationwide stories of dogs winding up back in shelters for rehoming, well-meaning adopters are having more trouble than they might have anticipated. The Washington Post reports more than 23 million pets found new homes in the U.S. during the pandemic. That translates to nearly one in five American households. With that uptick in adoptions, associated services such as daycare and boarding facilities are bursting at the seams. Long waiting lists are common. And while a puppy grabbing your socks and making a mad dash around the house might be cute for a week, nightly zoomies with a 70-pound dog can get, well, old and stressful. And not just for the humans, if the household has cats. Well, we'll get to that. My guest today is Lynn Swanson, a retired doctor of veterinary medicine. She volunteers at Safe Harbor Farm Canine Smile Project in northeastern North Carolina. She is the author of two books, including Smile and Other Practical Life Lessons Your Dogs Can Teach You While You Are Training Them. And I am learning, I must say. Today, we're going to explore some of the common challenges and admittedly some very strange ones so that the human end of the leash is setting up the dog end of the leash for success. Dr. Lynn Swanson, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much.
You said to me on the phone that religions have nothing on dog trainers. In fact, you say the only thing two trainers agree on is how wrong the third trainer is. Why is that? Are there really that many approaches to dog training?
There aren't a lot of different approaches to dog training. It's just that some trainers have a tendency to reach for certain tools, while others say, there is no way I would use that tool. It comes down, well, dog behavior too, and this is why we do what we do. Dog behavior is less about training, okay, that's nurture, than it is about nature, nurture, state of mind, energy level, associations, and routines. And pretty much everything comes down to communication.
Yeah.
And that's the gist of what we do.
And there are so many eye-opening moments for me in terms of what you teach about some of the differences in human psychology and canine psychology and also energy level. And we're going to get to that, but I'm so interested in your upbringing. You say that you grew up in a household with, at any given time, 20 to 25 dogs. What was that like for you as a kid, and what did you learn from the dogs?
Oh, I was a lucky kid. I was such a lucky kid because I had the best teachers around. So it was just an ambient energy of dogness in my household. And as far as the other lessons, too, it's just I learned, for one thing, my dad really did like dogs, even though he would sit in the kitchen and have two cats in his lap, four dogs at his feet, and he'd be petting everybody, saying how miserable he was and how he had to put up with all these animals. And then we would just sit there and roll our eyes at him and just say, you know, we're just lucky.
So that is unusual. Why would you have so many dogs in your household?
Oh, my mom liked to do the whole show thing. I was one of those dog show kids. She would do the confirmation work, and then I would do the obedience work. And that was eye-opening, and that was lots of fun. And some of the lessons I learned with my dogs were when things went wrong. You know what? We would have, her breed of choice was American Cocker Spaniels, not exactly known in the obedience world as being highly intelligent. They're not the poodles of the world. But, you know, we would do really well. The dogs would get all these top honors. But every once in a while, we were tied with somebody. And here's a situation, and I actually think I describe it in the book, where me and my dog, Debbie, we were up for top dog with another group, another person and their dog. And we had to kind of walk a pattern together. Dogs stayed at our side, and then we told them heel, and we walked straight ahead and turn around. Well, when I walked straight ahead and turned around, there was Debbie sitting there looking at me like, I'm tired. I did this once. I'm not having a good time. You are way too tense, and why should I follow you? And obviously the other team got the top dog honors, but I went home with an awesome lesson because I could have the best behaving dog, but yet if my dog wasn't having a good time, what good was that?
Right.
So my life with the dogs, you know, I mean, I'm 60-something, shall we say, and I've spent maybe 30 years working with large groups of dogs in different contexts. And they have always been the very best teachers. And again, some of the lessons were when the best lessons came about when something went wrong and I had to sit back and say, okay, why'd that happen? Mm-hmm. What am I missing? What am I misinterpreting?
And that's interesting because that's how you come at dog training in the book. You sort of lay out basic canine social rules, mm-hmm. and canine psychology and how it's different from human psychology. And of course, I probably should say that the reason we even connected is because I was walking my 70-pound rescue pandemic pup in a local neighborhood. And another woman with a dog was coming towards us, and her dog was, of course, very well behaved. And mine is like, "Oh, here comes another dog! Hi, 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 hi! I want to meet you. I want to jump all over you and smell your butt." And so the woman didn't look open to this. So I am trying to hold him, and all 70 pounds of this lab pit bull mix is straining at the leash, and I'm saying, "Drake, stop it! Settle down, Drake, stop!" And she calmly walks by, and then she turns around and she says, with her perfectly behaved dog, "You know, there's this woman who wrote a book
called story.
Smile. And it's a book about how to train your dog, but better yet, it improves the relationship between you and your dog. And you might want to check out the book." So I did, and then I found out that you, the woman who wrote the book, Smile, actually live and volunteer and work in northeastern North Carolina, which was a surprise. I thought she was talking about somebody in another city somewhere. But so much of this is about energy. And can you kind of talk about what happens with a dog when he is straining at the leash because there's another exciting dog coming towards him, and this is like the best thing in the world. It's Christmas all over again. He's a new buddy he's about to meet. But the owner is saying, "No, sit. No, behave. Stay." So why does that not work? What's happening?
Oh, my gosh. Where do I start? Okay, so people often talk in terms of a dog's behavior without recognizing that behind every behavior, there is a state of mind and an energy level. Okay. So if we want our dogs to be calm, we need to reward being calm. If we'd love our dogs to have a relaxed state of mind, we need to reward a relaxed state of mind. Now, when it comes to canine communication, dogs communicate with each other and with us through posture, position, movement, and energy. There's that energy you're talking about. Okay. So, and if we project energy that's over the top, it's not surprising that the energy we get back from our dogs is a bit over the top. Okay. And so what you describe is a classic situation where we suggest substitute behaviors. Okay. So rather than pull on your dog and shout at your dog and say, "Stop, what is wrong with you? You're driving me nuts, cut it out." In frustration and tension, that is reasonable, it's justified. It's just that it's going to work against you 100% of the time.
So, wait, Louie, it's going to work against you 100% of the time.
Yes, ma'am. And that's just the way the dogs are. So if he is giving you way too much energy in response to seeing a dog, mm-hmm. and you stop, which is also very human, You face the other human, which is also very human, and you become vocal, which is also very human. You're not giving Drake in that situation the means that set him up for success. However, if your substitute behavior is just to calmly turn around and walk the same direction as the dog coming to you. Like you're walking down, this dog is facing you with his new owner. If you turned 180 degrees so that, say, you're all going east, and that over your shoulder, you invite that other person to just walk parallel with you, like two airplane wings, perfectly parallel. You have Drake now at your side. And he's still acting like a dope on a rope. And yes, that's what we call it. You know, he's a dope on the rope. But in your mind, you're like, Drake is going to calm down. He's going to relax. I'm smiling and I'm looking ahead. And this person with this lovely dog is walking next to me. And I can just tell her to move on. And I can turn around and walk Drake in the other direction because she is now past me on my side. Or we can walk a little bit longer and she can tell me, hey, you know, what's your dog's name? Oh, my dog's name is this. You know, who trained your dog? Oh, this is how I got this information. You know, Drake now sees that every time another owner and dog approaches, Rachel's going to turn around. She's going to smile. She's going to relax. She's going to look up forward. She's going to bring me to her side. And we're going to wind up walking parallel with this dog who is now a new walking partner instead of somebody who gets mom worried and upset.
You're listening to Coastline. Lynn Swanson, retired doctor of veterinary medicine and author of Smile, is with us today. Smile and other practical life lessons your dogs can teach you while you're training them. After this short break, we'll hear how she says dog owners can best use dog parks for training and exercise and what not to do. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Lynn Swanson is a retired doctor of veterinary medicine, and she volunteers at Safe Harbor Farm Canine Smile Project in northeastern North Carolina. She's also the author of the book Smile and Other Practical Life Lessons Your Dogs Can Teach You While You're Training Them. Lynn, just before we went to break, we were talking about lowering the energy of a dog by walking with another dog in the same direction. And I want to talk about dog parks for a second, because that's another place that people with untrained dogs encounter each other, both the people and the other dogs. I've heard some trainers say you should never take your dog to a dog park, because there are all kinds of risks there, including unvaccinated dogs, including dogs who might become aggressive. You're walking into a soup of risk. But you actually hold up dog parks as really good opportunities for training, especially for humans. What can we learn at dog parks?
I'm so glad you said especially for humans, because 95% of any dog training is training the human side of the leash. And that is the mission. That is the gist behind what we do, to give the person the skills to succeed so that their dog succeeds. Okay. Now, when it comes to dog parks, there are pretty much two different kinds of dog parks. You have a public dog park where everybody can go to it. And yeah, you know, there are some risks. There are some issues. Anything can happen. But consider, if you can find some, and they're all over the place, a membership dog park, because a lot of dog parks have gone members only, because this way they can make sure everybody is vaccinated, everybody is neutered, that there has hopefully been some discussion of play styles, because your classic bully breed is going to have a different play style than, say, my Dobie Dulcie here.
Who is with us in the studio, by the way.
Yes.
Very quietly. My no one would have known.
My co-speaker, yes, Dulcie. Because Dulcie has a very dainty play style. If you play rough with her, she'll give you a look like, oh, you've hurt my feelings. Oh. And if the dog does it again, and a bully breed will, because that's what they do, then she said, okay, well, I'm going to nip your butt. You know, and that's where you have a confrontation. So
what's a bully breed?
Well, a bully breed would be like a pit bull or a mastiff. Those are considered bully breeds.
But you don't consider them dangerous dogs.
No. We don't do these this blanket labels of anything. I mean, if you there's dangerous dog owners. And there are dogs that have been made dangerous because their owners are unbalanced and the poor dog doesn't have a chance.
Yeah.
But we're not going to do, you know, the whole blanket labels. So back to the dog parks. What my recommendation is before you go to any dog park, go by yourself. Leave the dog at home. Go by yourself. Do you feel secure? Are you welcomed? Do you see concerns? Okay. Do other people say, oh, well, warning about this situation or warning about that? Or is it like, hi, would love you to be a member, but we are a membership-only park. You know, and is your dog vaccinated? And is your dog neutered? And what's your dog's play style? You're going to learn a lot right there. And if you find the right park, it can be an awesome situation. But you need to kind of train yourself as to what can go wrong and what can go right.
And that wouldn't be creepy to go by yourself without your dog. It's not the same thing as somebody going to a playground and watching kids play.
No, definitely not. Everybody wants you to admire their dog.
Right.
It's different.
So when we bring a dog to a dog park, there's a way to enter.
Absolutely.
That makes it safer and better for everybody. How do we do that?
Well, I've never seen a dog park that doesn't have this, but I'm sure they're out there, so I want everybody to look for it. Dog parks should have an entrance area where you go in one gate, and before you go into the dog park, there is another gate. So my recommendations, number one, exercise your dog before you go in the dog park. Okay, take him for a long walk. Take him for a long jog. If he's a super high-energy dog, jog him next to you on a bike. If you know how to treadmill him, walk him. Don't jog your dog on a treadmill. We don't jog dogs on treadmills, but we walk him on the treadmill. Okay, just to get some of the heebie-jeebies out of him, you know, to get that energy level down. So he is a polite member of Canine Society when he goes to the dog park. Then walk him up to the dog park. Don't let him walk you up to the dog park, because that's announcing to everybody that the dog's in charge of making decisions, and P.S., you're not. So walk him on up to the dog park. Go through the first gate. Drop your leash. You can leave the leash on, but just drop your leash. See what the energy is. Do the other dogs come up to the door, and are they all sniffing each other? Awesome, because noses don't bark and noses don't bite. Or are they jumping on the fence at each other? Okay, that's too much energy. So the tool in your toolbox then is probably the most important tool that I ever use working with dogs, and that's patience. Wait it out. Wait until the other dogs in the park turn their head and then turn back to you. Or turn their head and walk away and come back. Now you've got a lower energy. Make sure your dog is matching that energy. And just be patient. Be patient. Once everybody has walked away from the door and they're quiet, then unhook your dog's leash, open up the door, and go in the park first with your dog following you. That's telling everybody, and by everybody, I am talking about the dogs because they're going to be a lot more observant of this than the people. It's telling the other dogs that you will calmly, clearly, consistently, confidently, and canine intuitively, those are the 5 C's, make the decisions so your dog doesn't have to. And that's setting him up for success.
It's so interesting that when it comes to walking on the leash and going to a dog park, you're suggesting exercise before that when, you know, that's been my primary form of exercise, either a long walk, the point being to exercise him, or taking him to the dog park, the point being to exercise him. But you're saying get out that crazy puppy, lab pit bull, high energy first.
Yes, so that you're enjoying the team building aspect of taking that walk and even going to the park. Because when you go to a dog park and you walk around the park, your dog, yes, he's playing, but he's also using his brain to keep half an eye on you in all likelihood. And that's draining his energy even more because you're working his canine brain.
So let's talk about dogs who do get excited at the dog park. And, you know, there maybe some snarling starts and there's barking and maybe there's pretty aggressive wrestling and owners start shouting and it's multiple owners shouting. We all know from what you've explained about high energy and how that works against us as dog owners, how it works against our ability to lead. We know that's not the way, but how would you diffuse a situation that started?
Prevention, prevention, prevention. I mean, it really does come down to that. Because if you're at the point where you have dogs that are snarling, you're going to respond with the same concerned energy or the heightened energy. And you can see where this goes. It's just going to build energy upon energy upon energy upon energy. You throw in, you interject tension and frustration, and it's going to work against you 100% of the time. So if you see, for instance, I'm at a dog park, Dulcie's with me, and a bully breed, just because that's the example we used before, or it could be just a lab puppy or somebody with a higher energy level than her, has just been pushing her buttons too much. And I can just tell by looking at her, and she's just got that look like, okay, do something, human, so I don't have to. Well, this human gets moving. Okay, I'll just clap my hands. Come on, everybody. Walk on. And tapping the side of my leg, you'll know, if anybody who reads the book will understand, I don't use words as much as I use sounds a lot of times. Okay, I'll just make those sounds. I'll get her attention. I'll get the other dog's attention. And the next thing you know, we have defused this rebel-rousing thing and turned it into a, now we're walking over around the sidewalk thing.
Yeah. You mentioned sounds. Yes. So there are a lot of sounds that you describe as being useful. And I've already been experimenting with one particularly attractive sound. I mean, it's worse coming out of my mouth and my lungs than the sound before, you know, this is a test of the emergency broadcast system.
Oh, she did it ladylike, everybody. That was a very ladylike one.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
It stops. Sounds like a sick alarm clock.
Yes, very sick.
Yes.
And yeah, like the death rattle, and it stops Drake in his tracks.
Yeah.
But why are sounds so workable and so effective with dogs?
Okay. I'm just laughing because that's the sound that you chose because it's rather loud and it's like nobody likes that sound. There are definitely lots of little sounds we use that are quite pleasant, but that's annoying for a reason. That's the sound that I use if I need to correct a large number of dogs that I can't see and I can't discern who the instigator is. So if I was hearing a bunch of dogs getting rowdy and I knew who the instigator was, I would call out that dog's name. Olive, cut it out. And Olive would be like, oh, darn, she's around here someplace. She knows what I'm doing, you know. But say I'm like, you know, down the road and the dogs are getting rowdy and I don't know who it is. That's where I use that obnoxious alarm clock sound. And it basically is a reboot. A lot of times people will use the word no, and this is really important. No is going to work against you a lot of the times because it is very hard for us as humans not to lean forward and project energy down at a dog when we say no. But if we say, okay, or some other silly sound that will get our dog's attention and reboot their energy. That sound actually, if you experiment with this, you'll find that it projects right, it projects left, it projects up. It just is just this burst of sound and energy that you're putting into the air, but it's not directed at the dog per se. It gets their attention. But they don't have to respond like, wait a minute, you're over the top. Wait a minute, you're tense. Wait a minute, you're frustrated. Because being a dog, it's very hard for them to ever understand that they are the source of your frustration or tension. It's P.S. It's never them.
That's amazing.
Kids are less instinctual and more intellectual. We intellectualize everything, okay? Yeah, and we're very verbal. That's us and that's our kids. But dogs are instinctual. Okay, here's an instinctual sound. What does it sound like?
A snake.
Exactly. Okay. So that's the sound I use when I have a dog with me. I'm introducing to the concept of backing up politely when we go through a gate. So as I'm opening the gate door, I'm going, and the dog, we don't have to have a conversation about, hey, dog, this is what the sound means. It's instinctual. The dog backs up. That's where I can give him a great big smile. I go, that's good.
And so the title of your book is Smile.
Yeah.
And let's talk about why you decided to name the book Smile and how important it is. You've already, when you've been explaining different techniques, different tactics, you've talked about picturing in your head the way you want it to unfold. Like if you're walking your dog and there's another dog coming and mm-hmm. you turn the, so you're walking in the same direction and eventually you're walking abreast with the other dog owner and the other dog, and you're imagining peaceful dogs walking. You talk a lot about picturing the outcome you want in your mind. What does that do? And what does smiling do?
Okay, well, smiles first. Okay. This book could not be called anything but Smile. With a great big exclamation point and other practical life lessons your dogs can teach you while you're training them. Because when you smile, when you offer a smile to the world at large, number one, your blood pressure drops. Studies have shown this, okay? You may not know it's happened, but your dogs do, okay? When you smile at the world at large, you don't even have to be smiling at anything in particular, your happy endorphin levels rise. You may not know what's happened, but your dogs, every dog around you with a nose, knows that. Your muscles relax, especially your muscles in your shoulder, back, and arms.
Wait a minute. You're saying my dog can smell my endorphins?
They can smell changes in your body chemistry.
Wow.
And what's really cool about this, too, is that when you offer a smile, I mean, and we're not talking... What is it, grimaces?
Right.
You know, we're talking an up to your eyes, oh my gosh, I am so proud of you and I love life smile.
Yeah.
Okay. That kind of smile, it also triggers your diaphragm, that great big muscle down by your rib cage, to allow for a natural deep breath. So you basically, your body just got a hit of life saving oxygen. And that's all because you smiled. Okay. Smiles are free, they're always with you. They can't be dropped by arthritic hands, and they don't leave crumbs in your pockets. Smiles can be used selectively when you're working with multiple dogs, and you don't even have to be working or looking at a dog for your smile to send its message.
You're saying a smile can be a reward to a dog.
And that's what we do. Because if, let's say you're Drake, okay? You are your best buddy, Drake, and you've got, you are Drake, I'll get this right, and I have got a biscuit in my hand. Where is your attention?
On the biscuit in your hand.
And what is your energy level like?
It's probably pretty high.
Whoopee!
But yeah, my butt'll wag, but I will definitely do whatever you want me to do to get that biscuit. I'll sit, I'll give you my paw, I'll lie down, whatever you want me to do.
And but, possibly all three things at once, because you're not thinking about anything but what?
The biscuit.
You better believe it. But if, on the other hand, you work for smiles, you work for genuine, well-timed, I am so proud of that decision you made, Jake. Excuse me, smiles? Where is your attention?
On you.
Right. Specifically where?
On your face.
That's right. And what's your energy level going to be like?
Calmer.
Yes. It is so, so powerful. Now, we're not treat meanies. Okay, I'll pull out a treat periodically if I want more pep in a dog step. If I want to turn negative associations into positive ones, you better believe I'm going to pick out a piece of steak. And I don't even eat meat. but I'll pull out a piece of steak for you. Okay? But for most of the time, when you have dogs that work for smiles, you're communicating, you're connecting. It is so much better for you. Okay? And back to that situation where you're walking, you're doing this parallel airplane wing parallel walking with another person and their dog. And yes, your dog's jumping around a little bit at your side, but you're looking up because if you were focusing at your dog, who's making decisions and who's not? He's making decisions. So you're looking up, so you're making decisions, and I want you to smile. Because if the alternative is for you to be tense, that tension's going to start with the picture in your head, come down to your shoulders, go down your arm, down the leash to who?
My dog, Drake.
You got
it. So he's not only going to smell my stanky pheromones.
Your happy endorphins.
Right. Yes. But he's going to physically feel the tension in my arms and shoulders, even if I think my arms are relaxed. But if I am in a state of mental tension.
You're not fooling him.
Yeah.
You're not fooling him.
I want to ask you about the balance between expecting your dog to obey the rules and enforcing those rules. And even as I say that, I wonder if that's a bad term to use, versus just letting him be a dog.
Okay. Let's use Dulcie as an example. Okay. So yeah. As we're speaking, I have my third of a succession of Vertigo Assistant Service Dogs.
And we are going to have to come back to that. I knew we were getting into a break.
Works for me.
Yeah. You're listening to Coastline. Retired Doctor of Veterinary Medicine Lynn Swanson is my guest today. We'll hear about when we should let a dog be a dog, and we'll also find out how owners can troubleshoot some of those seemingly intractable behaviors. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring the world of dog training through the eyes and minds and hearts of dogs. As Dr. Lynn Swanson is explaining, some elements of canine psychology are nearly opposite of human social behavior, and those gaps in human understanding can reinforce problems between dogs and humans. Her book, Smile, and Other Practical Life Lessons Your Dogs Can Teach You While You Are Training Them, first explains important elements of canine psychology and then shows you ways to train your dogs using those principles. And Dr. Swanson, just before we went to break, we were talking about when you require obedience and when you just let a dog be a dog. And your service dog, Dulcie, is here quietly. She hasn't said a word. But she's looked back at me as if to say, why is she staring at me? So she's on duty right now. When do you let her be a dog and let her play and sniff and whatever else?
Well, first of all, it is extremely important that she gets time to be a dog. Okay, and that comes down to one word, and that word is balance. So there needs to be a balance with it. When it comes to everything else, it kind of comes down to the five C's of communication. Clear, consistent, confident. Okay, I just forgot.
And it'll
canine
pop into
intuitive.
Your head.
You better
there
believe
you go.
Yes. Canine intuitive. And then, yes, there's one other. But bottom line is, like with Dulcie, to be consistent, if she is wearing her uniform, she's working. There's a particular set of expectations that she knows I have. Okay. When the uniform's off, okay, then the expectations might drop a little bit. No, she cannot barrel a newcomer over. Yes, she must approach a new dog politely. You know, there are just certain rules that we have in our household that just make her a pleasant dog to be around. But those rules do change when she's in her uniform. She's at my side. She's focused on me. She needs to really dig down and trust me that this person with a very noisy shopping cart isn't going to clip her accidentally. When she goes home, that pack comes off, and we might go for a walk in the woods, or she gets to run around with her dog buddies. There's a balance. So a lot of times people say, well, you know, your dog is just so polite. This dog must be miserable. Not at all. We have such a connection. This dog is an important member of our team. You know, she and I, we're a team.
And she finds security in that.
Without a doubt. Security is a big word. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm clear with my expectations. She knows that I'm going to be confident because she won't follow a hesitant person. Dogs don't do that readily. I'm consistent. I'm not one way one day and another way the next. So she can trust in me. And I'm going to approach what she's doing in a canine intuitive way. I'm going to be sensitive to the culture she was born into and the social rules and social cues that were taught to her by her mama dog way before she ever got to be with any person. And this dog, and I had mentioned this during our break, she started off life running around loose on the Texas-Mexican border. So the rules and boundaries and everything that she was taught when she was young came primarily from the dogs that she was with, and less so with humans. You know, I only work with the rescues. Different thing. But pack off, the dogs have time to relax and be a dog. Pack on, or in Drake's case, a leash on. Oh, okay. Now, until mom tells me, go out, I'm to walk nicely at her side. But every once in a while, mom looks at me, and I look at mom, and she says, go out. And then I can get to sniff at everything all over the place and have a good time. So a little bit of everything. But you're making the decisions so Drake doesn't have to. You're setting him up for success.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that probably no one else ever would want to ask or care about, but I have to do it anyway. So when Drake came into our household, he never jumped on people. Mm-hmm. I taught him to jump.
Okay.
Because I like to jump with my dog.
Yeah.
I like to come home and jump with my dog. So now he jumps on everybody and it's a problem. And my husband tells everybody, well, that's what she taught him. And so is there a way, because I have heard from a good friend and source of all things dog, that it's possible to jump with Drake and then be able to command him to not jump on other people and have him know the difference? Does that make your head explode? Or
no, not at all. Okay. Not at all, because that's your situation. So we're going to need to work with the situation as we've got it. Okay. So a couple things come to mind. First off is counting the jumps. Okay. So jump one, jump two, jump three. That's enough. Okay. So he gets to do what you wanted him to do because you're telling him jump one, jump two, jump three. Notice a difference in my voice. A little sing-songy. We're getting to the end. That's enough. You've set a limit on it. It's the same thing we do with barking dogs, dogs that alert bark. Okay, they are doing their job. They're telling you, hey, Ma, there's somebody out there. Okay, telling him no, don't bark will not compute in his doggy brain.
Right.
Because he's being the super watchdog. He's taking care of you.
He needs to keep alerting you until you get it.
He's telling you, that's right, somebody's there. And if you're tense, he's going to associate your tension with that stranger coming down the driveway, you know, who might be somebody you want to see. He'll never think that that tension is directed at him because of his behavior. So he gives one bark, that's one. Bark, that's two. Bark, that's three. That's enough. He gets to be the super watchdog he wants to be, and you get to set a limit on that behavior. Now, that's one thing. The other thing that's important for you to do is teach Drake a substitute behavior. Get back. So he moves back from anybody else, so jumping isn't an option.
That makes sense. We've heard so many people say you should never let your dog sleep in your bed. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, unless it's one of the little foo-foos that is just such a benign sweetheart of a dog who doesn't take it to the next level. There are so many dogs who will see it as being an equal decision maker. So to be clear, my dogs never sleep with me. They sleep next to me. Next to me meaning on the floor on their own wonderful comfy dog bed. They are part of my family, but they just don't sleep in
and
the bed.
And so you don't let your need to cuddle them and squeeze them in the way of...
We do cuddling other times. It's just not a bed thing. Yeah. Because that can confuse a lot of dogs. You're sending mixed messages to them.
Let's talk about tools for a moment. For when you're trying to leash train a dog, and the dog is a puller, there are some people who say prong collars are the only way to go, and that's the only way that the dog is going to understand that he's pulling in a way that isn't constructive. Do you think prong collars are something? Are they a useful tool?
I am asked this so very often because we do have a subset of trainers that train every dog to their favorite tool, and that's not fair. There's no tool that will fit every dog. Okay. So when it comes to pulling dogs, number one, to set a dog up for success is before you start doing leash work with that dog. Okay, that's a dog who I'm sitting on my trike. He's tied to the basket of my trike. We're going to go for a run first because he needs to be a certain level of tiredness. He needs to get the heebie-jeebies out of him before I ask him to do what I want to do. See, we have a saying, I need to meet the dog's needs before he can meet mine. If I have a need for that dog to not pull me around and I'm not a strong individual, I'm fairly fragile physically, so I can't have dogs pull me around. P.S. to everybody, if it's not a no-pull harness, it's a pulling harness. You got two types, and that's it. So if it's not a no-pull harness, it's a pulling harness. And a lot of people are set up for failure when they put a cute little pulling harness on their dog, especially if they attach a extendable leash, which provides constant tension on that dog's back. That dog pulls forward, you pull back. That dog pulls forward, you pull back. Actually, you don't pull back. The leash is pulling back.
So,
and you have a lack of communication there. Yeah. A complete breakdown of communication.
Yeah.
That dog's not set up to succeed. You got the wrong tools there.
So I understand what you're talking about when you talk about the harness with the ring, with the chest ring. And that's something that if the dog pulls, then it tends, the leash sort of pulls around the dog's leg and it makes it hard for the dog to go forward.
Some dogs do well with them. Dulcie's one. Some dogs hate them. So whatever tool I reach for, which once in a blue moon might include a prong collar, okay, it's not my go-to tool by far, maybe once every other year, okay? But if I put it on a dog and the dog relaxes, I'm like, that's the right tool. This is the right tool for him.
What is a no-pull harness with the ring on the back? What's the difference between a pull harness and a no-pull harness?
The no-pull harnesses with the ring on the back. The one I like the best has these Sherpa sleeves that go underneath the dog's legs, the front legs. And it has a ring that you attach your leash to on the back that, if you apply gentle pressure upward, is always ideal, not back, but upward if you can, it puts gentle pressure on both sides equally of the dog's chest. So they can't take that deep breath and start pulling you around. It's great for little old ladies paired with these little foo-foos who like to pull and pull and pull. And frankly, the little old lady's never going to do anything about it. It just kind of gives her the edge.
You're listening to Coastline. Lynn Swanson is my guest today, retired doctor of veterinary medicine. She wrote the book Smile and Other Practical Life Lessons Your Dog Can Teach You While You're Training Them. So when we're talking about troubleshooting with specific problems, I have a friend who also adopted a pandemic puppy, a little Boston Terrier, 23 pounds.
I love Boston Terrorizers.
Well, that is her issue.
Yes.
So this dog pays attention, sees her husband as the authority, but will grab her slippers and run off with them, nips at her, basically acts as if the slippers on her feet are tug-of-war toys. It's been really difficult for her.
If you don't mind me going through a little list, I think this is going to be informative, because when we're troubleshooting misbehaviors, number one, and you gave me a perfect example when you were talking about Drake and the jumping earlier, okay? Number one is, has a dog been rewarded for it in the past? So if you touch a dog, it's a reward. If you talk to a dog, it's a reward. If you lean down to touch the dog, it's a reward. And people often reward dogs for behaviors without realizing it. They might giggle and think it's cute the first time. Uh-oh, the dog is going to continue doing it even if you say, no, I don't like that anymore. Doesn't work. Number two, a dog may be doing what he's doing because he has a negative association with that. Okay, your classic example, guy walking down the street with, he's a tall man with a beard, sunglasses, and a hat. Your dog growls at him. There's a negative association. We need to turn that around. Number three, the owner has failed to show the dog alternate behaviors, like don't pull on the slipper. Instead, the way to get my attention is to sit back and watch me. You get this great big smile and, oh, yeah, okay, maybe we'll pull a biscuit out of our pocket. But the first reward is for your attention on me and your calm energy and your relaxation. And I'm going to reward that with a beautiful smile that connects us. And, oh, by the way, here's a biscuit. A dog can be doing something. Oh, this happens all the time. When as soon as somebody tells me my dog always does something, I know it's part of a routine. It's part of a routine that the dog's picked up on. And the answer to that is change it for a different routine. Okay, that's easy. Chapter 5 of the book, dogs love routines. A dog may be looking for an outlet for his pent-up energy. Enough said there. The behavior could be instinctual. After all, he is a dog. Alert barking, perfect example of that one. A dog could be responding to an owner's tension. Again, these are people who they don't have the skill set to know that the word no is going to work against them. It's going to project tension. And even if that tension is justified, it's going to work against them 100% of the time. A dog could be responding to the negative picture in your mind. We talked about that. And or your dog is doing what he's doing because you have failed to follow through in the past. You let him get away with it a couple times. You're inconsistent with being clear. And again, that's a skill. That's a skill, because a lot of times our go-to response to a dog's behavior is frustration. So we do have to work to have a different approach.
Yeah, and that's so good to remember that when the dog is being quiet and attentive,
yes,
that's the time to reward.
Yes.
Because
don't take it for granted.
Right, exactly. Think about that. That's this edition of Coastline. Lynn Swanson, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
The book is Smile and Other Practical Life Lessons Your Dogs Can Teach You While You're Training Them. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. You can find this episode at whqr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.